Chapter 32. The deep roar of the ocean. The break of waves on further shores than thought can find. The silent thunders of the deep. And from among it, voices calling, and yet not voices. Humming trillings, wordlings, the half-articulated songs of thought. Greetings, waves of greetings sliding back down into the inarticulate, words breaking together. A crash of sorrow on the shores of earth. Waves of joy on, where, a world indescribably found, indescribably arrived at, indescribably wet, a song of water. A fugue of voices now, clamouring explanations of a disaster unavertible, a world to be destroyed, a surge of helplessness, a spasm of despair, a dying fall, again the break of words. And then the fling of hope, the finding of a shadow earth in the implications of enfolded time, submerged dimensions, the pull of parallels, the deep pull, the spin of will, the hurl and split of it, the flight. A new earth pulled into replacement, the dolphins gone. Then stunningly, a single voice, quite clear. This bowl was brought to you by the campaign to save the humans. We bid you farewell. And then the sound of long, heavy, perfectly grey bodies rolling away into an unknown, fathomless deep, quietly giggling. Chapter 33. That night they stayed outside the asylum and watched TV from inside it. "This is what I wanted you to see," said Wonka the Sane when the news came around again. "An old colleague of mine, he's over in your country running an investigation. Just watch." It was a press conference. "I'm afraid I can't comment on the name Rain God at the present time, and we are calling him an example of a spontaneous paracausal meteorological phenomenon." "Can you tell us what that means?" "I'm not altogether sure. Let's be straight here. If we find something we can't understand, we like to call it something you can't understand, or indeed pronounce. I mean, if we just let you go around calling him a rain god, then that suggests you know something we don't, and I'm afraid we couldn't have that. Now, first we have to call it something which says it's ours, not yours. Then we set about finding some way of proving it's not what you said it is, but something we say it is. And if it turns out that you're right, you'll still be wrong, because we will simply call him a supernormal, not paranormal or supernatural, because you think you know what those mean now. No, a supernormal's incremental precipitation inducer. We'll probably want to shove a quasi in there somewhere to protect ourselves. Rain God, never heard such nonsense in my life. Admittedly, you wouldn't catch me going holiday with him. Thanks, that'll be all for now, other than to say hi to Wonko if he's watching." Chapter 34. On the way home, there was a woman sitting next to them on the plane who was looking at them rather oddly. They talked quietly to themselves. "I still have to know," said Fenchurch, "and I strongly feel that you know something you're not telling me." Arthur sighed and took out a piece of paper. "Do you have a pencil?" he said. She dug around and found one. "What are you doing, sweetheart?" she said, after he had spent 20 minutes frowning, chewing the pencil, scribbling on the paper, crossing things out, scribbling again, chewing the pencil again, and grunting irritably to himself. "Trying to remember an address someone once gave me." "Your life would be an awful lot simpler," she said, "if you bought yourself an address book." Finally, he passed the paper to her. "You look after it," he said. She looked at it. Among all the scratchings and crossings out were the words "Quenchilus Quasgar Mountains," "Sevelby Upstry," "Planet of Priliumtarn," "Sun Zas," "Galactic Sector QQZ Active J Gamma." "And what's there?" "Apparently," said Arthur, "it's God's final message to his creation." "That sounds a bit more like it," said Fenchurch. "How do we get there?" "You really?" "Yes," said Fenchurch firmly. "I really want to know." Arthur looked out of the scratchy little perspex window at the open sky outside. Excuse me," said the woman who'd been looking at them rather oddly, suddenly. "I hope you don't think I'm rude. I get so bored in these long flights. It's nice to talk to somebody. My name's Enid Capelson. I'm from Boston. Tell me, do you fly a lot?" Chapter 35. They went to Arthur's house in the West Country, shoved a couple of towels and stuff in a bag, and then sat down to do what every galactic hitchhiker ends up spending most of his time doing. They waited for a flying saucer to come by. "A friend of mine did this for 15 years, said Arthur one night as they sat forlornly watching the sky. "Who was that?" "Called Ford Prefect." He caught himself doing something he'd never really expected to do again. He wondered where Ford Prefect was. By an extraordinary coincidence, the following day there were two reports in the paper, one concerning the most astonishing incident with the flying saucer, and the other about a series of unseemly riots in pubs. Ford Prefect turned up the day after that, looking hungover and complaining that Arthur never answered the phone. In fact, he looked extremely ill, not merely as if he had been pulled through a hedge backwards, but as if the hedge was being simultaneously pulled backwards through a combine harvester. He staggered into Arthur's sitting room, waving aside all offers of support, which was an error, because the effort of waving caused himself to lose his balance altogether, and Arthur eventually had to drag him to the sofa. "Thank you," said Ford. "Thank you very much. Have you..." he said, and fell asleep for 3 hours. "The faintest idea," he continued suddenly when he revived, "how hard it is to tap into the British phone system from the Pleiades?" "I can see that you haven't, so I'll tell you," he said, "over that very large mug of black coffee you're about to make me." He followed Arthur wobblily into the kitchen. "Stupid operators keep asking you where you're calling from, and you try and tell them Letchworth, and they say you couldn't be if you're coming in on that circuit. What are you doing?" "Making you some black coffee." "Oh." Ford seemed oddly disappointed. He looked about the place forlornly. "What's this?" he said. "Rice Krispies." "And this?" "Paprika." "I see," said Ford solemnly, and put the two items back down, one on top of the other. But that didn't seem to balance properly, so he put the other on top of the one, and that seemed to work. A little space lagged," he said. "What was I saying?" "About not phoning from Letchworth." "I wasn't. I explained this to the lady." "Bugger Letchworth," I said, "if that's your attitude. I am, in fact, calling from a sales scout ship of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation, currently on the sub-lightspeed leg of a journey between the stars known to your world, though not necessarily to you, dear lady." "I said, dear lady," explained Ford Prefect, because I didn't want her to be offended by my implication that she was an ignorant cretin. "Tactful," said Arthur Dent. "Exactly," said Ford. "Tactful." He frowned. "Space lag," he said, "is very bad for sub-clauses. You'll have to assist me," he continued, "by reminding me what I was talking about." "Between the stars," said Arthur, "known to your world, though not necessarily to you, dear lady, as Pleiades Epsilon and Pleiades Zeta," concluded Ford triumphantly. "This conversation, Lark, is quite a gas, isn't it?" "Have some coffee." "Thank you, no. And the reason," I said, "why I am bothering you with it, rather than just dialing direct as I could, because we have some pretty sophisticated telecommunications equipment out here in the Pleiades, I can tell you, is that the penny-pinching son of a starbeast piloting this son of a starbeast starship insists that I call collect. Can you believe that?" "And could she?" "I don't know. She'd hung up," said Ford by this time. "So, what do you suppose," he asked fiercely, "I did next?"
"I've no idea, Ford," said Arthur.
"Pity," said Ford. "I was hoping you could remind me. I really hate those guys, you know. They really are the creeps of the cosmos, buzzing around the celestial infinite with their junky little machines that never work properly, or when they do, perform functions that no sane man would require of them. And," he added savagely, "go beep to tell you when they'd done it." This was perfectly true, and a very respectable view, widely held by right-thinking people, who are largely recognisable as being right-thinking people by the mere fact that they hold this view. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in a moment of reasoned lucidity, which is almost unique amongst its current tally of 5,975,509 pages, says of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation products that it is very easy to be blinded to the essential uselessness of them by the sense of achievement you get from getting them to work at all. In other words, and this is the rock-solid principle on which the whole of the corporation's galaxy-wide success is founded, their fundamental design flaws are completely hidden by their superficial design flaws. "And this guy," ranted Ford, "was on a drive to sell more of them. His 5-year mission to seek out and explore strange new worlds and sell advanced music substitute systems to their restaurants, elevators and wine bars. Or if they didn't have restaurants, elevators and wine bars yet, to artificially accelerate their civilization growth until they bloody well did have. Where's that coffee?"
"I threw it away."
"Make some more. I've now remembered what I did next. I saved civilization as we know it. I knew it was something like that." He stumbled determinedly back into the sitting room, where he seemed to carry on talking to himself, tripping over the furniture and making beep-beep noises. A couple of minutes later, wearing his very placid face, Arthur followed him. Ford looked stunned. Where have you been? He demanded. Making some coffee, said Arthur, still wearing his very placid face. He had long ago realized that the only way of being in Ford's company successfully was to keep a large stock of very placid faces and wear them at all times. You missed the best bit, raged Ford. You missed the bit where I jumped the guy. Now, he said, I'll have to jump him all over again. He hurled himself recklessly at a chair and broke it. It was better, he said sullenly last time, and waved vaguely in the direction of another broken chair, which he'd already got trussed up on the dining room table. I see, said Arthur, casting a placid eye over the trussed-up wreckage. And, what are all the ice cubes for? What? Screamed Ford. What, you missed that bit too? That's the suspended animation facility. I put the guy in the suspended animation facility. Well, I had to, didn't I? So it would seem, said Arthur in his placid voice. Don't touch that! Yelled Ford. Arthur, who was about to replace the phone, which was for some mysterious reason lying on the table off the hook, paused placidly. Okay, said Ford, calming down. Listen to it. Arthur put the phone to his ear. It's the speaking clock, he said. Beep, 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 said Ford, is exactly what is being heard all over that guy's ship, while he sleeps in the ice, going slowly round the little-known moon of Sesiphus Magna, the London speaking clock. I see, said Arthur again, and decided that now was the time to ask the big one. Why? He said placidly. With a bit of luck, said Ford, the phone bill will bankrupt the buggers. He threw himself sweating onto the sofa. Anyway, he said, dramatic arrival, don't you think? Chapter 36. The flying saucer in which Ford Prefect had stowed away had stunned the world. Finally, there was no doubt, no possibility of mistake, no hallucinations, no mysterious CIA agents found floating in reservoirs. This time it was real, it was definite, it was definitely definite. It had come down with a wonderful disregard for anything beneath it and crushed a large area of some of the most expensive real estate in the world, including much of Harrods. The thing was massive, nearly a mile across, some said, dull silver in colour, pitted, scorched and disfigured with the scars of unnumbered vicious space battles fought with savage forces by the light of suns unknown to man. A hatchway opened, crashed down through the Harrods food halls, demolished Harvey Nichols, and with a final grinding scream of tortured architecture, toppled the Sheraton Park Tower. After a long, heart-stopping moment of internal crashes and grumbles of rending machinery, there marched from it down the ramp an immense silver robot, 100 feet tall. It held up a hand. "I come in peace," it said, adding after a long moment of further grinding, "take me to your lizard." Ford Prefect, of course, had an explanation for this, as he sat with Arthur and watched the non-stop frenetic news reports on the television, none of which had anything to say other than to record that the thing had done this amount of damage, which was valued at that amount of billions of pounds, and had killed this totally other number of people, and then say it again, because the robot was doing nothing more than standing there, swaying very slightly, and emitting short, incomprehensible error messages. "It comes from a very ancient democracy, you see," said Ford. "You mean it comes from a world of lizards?" "No," said Ford, who by this time was a little more rational and coherent than he had been, having finally had the coffee forced down him. "Nothing so simple. Nothing anything like so straightforward. On its world, the people are people. The leaders are lizards. The people hate the lizards, and the lizards rule the people." "Odd," said Arthur. "I thought you said it was a democracy." "I did," said Ford. "It is." "So," said Arthur, hoping he wasn't sounding ridiculously obtuse, "why don't the people get rid of the lizards?" "It honestly doesn't occur to them," said Ford. "They've all got the vote, so they all pretty much assume that the government they voted in more or less approximates to the government they want." "You mean they actually vote for the lizards?" "Oh, yes," said Ford with a shrug, "of course." "But," said Arthur, going for the big one again, "why?" "Because if they didn't vote for a lizard," said Ford, "the wrong lizard might get in. Got any gin?" "What?" "I said," said Ford, with an increasing air of urgency creeping into his voice, "have you got any gin?" I'll look. Tell me about the lizards." Ford shrugged again. "Some people say that the lizards are the best thing that ever happened to them," he said. "They're completely wrong, of course, completely and utterly wrong, but someone's got to say it." "But that's terrible," said Arthur. "Listen, bud," said Ford, "if I had one Altarian dollar for every time I heard one bit of the universe look at another bit of the universe and say, 'That's terrible,'
I wouldn't be sitting here like a lemon looking for a gin. But I haven't, and I am. Anyway, what are you looking so placid and moon-eyed for? Are you in love? Arthur said, yes, he was, and said it placidly. With someone who knows where the gin bottle is, do I get to meet her? He did, because Fenchurch came in at that moment with a pile of newspapers she'd been to the village to buy. She stopped in astonishment at the wreckage on the table and the wreckage from Beetlejuice on the sofa. "Where's the gin?" said Ford to Fenchurch, and to Arthur. "What happened to Trillian, by the way?"
This is Fenchurch," said Arthur awkwardly. "There was nothing with Trillian. You must have seen her last."
"Oh, yeah," said Ford. "She went off with Zaphod somewhere. They had some kids or something. At least," he added, "I think that's what they were. Zaphod's calmed down a lot, you know."
"Really?" said Arthur, clustering hurriedly around Fenchurch to relieve her of the shopping.
"Yeah," said Ford. "At least one of his heads is now saner than an emu on acid."
"Arthur, who is this?" said Fenchurch.
"Ford Prefect," said Arthur. "I may have mentioned him in passing."
Chapter 37. For a total of 3 days and nights, the giant silver robot stood in stunned amazement, straddling the remains of Knightsbridge, swaying slightly and trying to work out a number of things. Government deputations came to see it, ranting journalists by the truckload each asked each other questions on the air about what they thought of it. Flights of fighter bombers tried pathetically to attack it, but no lizards appeared. It scanned the horizon slowly. At night, it was at its most spectacular, floodlit by the teams of television crews who covered it continuously, as it continuously did nothing. It thought and thought, and eventually reached a conclusion. It would have to send out its service robots. It should have thought of that before, but it was having a number of problems. The tiny flying robots came screeching out of the hatchway one afternoon in a terrifying cloud of metal. They roamed the surrounding terrain, frantically attacking some things and defending others. One of them at last found a pet shop with some lizards, but it instantly defended the pet shop for democracy so savagely that little in the area survived. A turning point came when a crack team of flying screechers discovered the zoo in Regent's Park, and most particularly the reptile house. Learning a little caution from their previous mistakes in the pet shop, the flying drills and fret saws brought some of the larger and fatter iguanas to the giant silver robot, who tried to conduct high-level talks with them. Eventually, the robot announced to the world that despite the full, frank, and wide-ranging exchange of views, the high-level talks had broken down, the lizards had been retired, and that it, the robot, would take a short holiday somewhere, and for some reason selected Bournemouth. Ford Prefect, watching it on TV, nodded, laughed, and had another beer. Immediate preparations were made for its departure. The flying toolkit screeched and sawed and drilled and fried things with light throughout that day and all through the night time, and in the morning, stunningly, a giant mobile gantry started to roll westwards on several roads simultaneously, with the robot standing on it, supported within the gantry. Westward it crawled like a strange carnival buzzed around by its servants and helicopters and news coaches, scything through the land until at last it came to Bournemouth, where the robot slowly freed itself of its transport system's embraces and went and lay for 10 days on the beach. It was, of course, by far the most exciting thing that had ever happened to Bournemouth. Crowds gathered daily along the perimeter, which was staked out and guarded as the robot's recreation area, and tried to see what it was doing. It was doing nothing. It was lying on the beach. It was lying a little awkwardly on its face. It was a journalist from a local paper who, late one night, managed to do what no one else in the world had so far managed, which was to strike up a brief, intelligible conversation with one of the service robots guarding the perimeter. It was an extraordinary breakthrough. "I think there's a story in it," confided the journalist over a cigarette shared through the steel link fence, "but it needs a good local angle. I've got a little list of questions here," he went on, rummaging awkwardly in an inner pocket. "Perhaps you could get him, it, whatever you call him, to run through them quickly." The little flying ratchet screwdriver said it would see what it could do and screeched off. A reply was never forthcoming. Curiously, however, the questions on the piece of paper more or less exactly matched the questions that were going through the massive, battle-scarred, industrial-quality circuits of the robot's mind. They were these. How do you feel about being a robot? How does it feel to be from outer space? And how do you like Bournemouth? Early the following day, things started to be packed up, and within a few days it became apparent that the robot was preparing to leave for good.
"The point is," said Fenchurch to Ford, "can you get us on board?"
Ford looked wildly at his watch.
"I have some serious unfinished business to attend to," he exclaimed.
Chapter 38. Crowds thronged as close as they could to the giant silver craft, which wasn't very. The immediate perimeter was fenced off and patrolled by the tiny flying service robots. Staked out around that was the army, who had been completely unable to breach that inner perimeter, but were damned if anybody was going to breach them. They, in turn, were surrounded by a cordon of police, though whether they were there to protect the public from the army, or the army from the public, or to guarantee the giant ship's diplomatic immunity and prevent it getting parking tickets, was entirely unclear, and the subject of much debate. The inner perimeter fence was now being dismantled. The army stirred uncomfortably, uncertain of how to react to the fact that the reason for their being there seemed as if it was simply going to get up and go. The giant robot had lurched back aboard the ship at lunchtime, and now it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and no further sign had been seen of it. Much had been heard, more grindings and rumblings from deep within the craft, the music of a million hideous malfunctions, but the sense of tense expectation among the crowd was born of the fact that they tensely expected to be disappointed. This wonderful, extraordinary thing had come into their lives and now was simply going to go without them. Two people were particularly aware of this sensation. Arthur and Fenchurch scanned the crowd anxiously, unable to find Ford Prefect in it anywhere, or any sign that he had the slightest intention of being there.
"How reliable is he?" asked Fenchurch in a sinking voice.
"How reliable?" said Arthur. He gave a hollow laugh. "How shallow is the ocean," he said, "how cold is the sun?" The last parts of the robot's gantry transport were being carried on board, and the few remaining sections of the perimeter fence were now stacked at the bottom of the ramp, waiting to follow them. The soldiers on guard around the ramp bristled meaningfully. Orders were barked back and forth, hurried conferences were held, but nothing, of course, could be done about any of it. Hopelessly, and with no clear plan now, Arthur and Fenchurch pushed forward through the crowd. But since the whole crowd was also trying to push forward through the crowd, this got them nowhere. And within a few minutes more, nothing remained outside the ship. Every last link of the fence was aboard. A few flying fretsaws and a spirit level seemed to do one last check around the site, and then screamed in through the giant hatchway themselves. A few seconds passed. The sounds of mechanical disarray from within changed in intensity, and slowly, heavily, the huge steel ramp began to lift itself back out of the Harrods food halls. The sound that accompanied it was the sound of thousands of tense, excited people being completely ignored.
"Hold it!"
A megaphone barked from a taxi, which screeched to a halt on the edge of the milling crowd.
"There has been," barked the megaphone, "a major scientific break-in! Through! Breakthrough!" It corrected itself.
The door flew open, and a small man from somewhere in the vicinity of Beetlejuice leapt out, wearing a white coat.
"Hold it!"
he shouted again, and this time brandished a short, squat, black rod with lights on it. The lights winked briefly, the ramp paused in its ascent, and then, in obedience to the signals from the thumb, which half the electronic engineers in the galaxy are constantly trying to find fresh ways of jamming, while the other half are constantly trying to find fresh ways of jamming the jamming signals, slowly ground its way downwards again. Ford Prefect grabbed his megaphone from out of the taxi and started bawling at the crowd through it.
"Make way," he shouted. "Make way, please. This is a major scientific breakthrough. You and you get the equipment from the taxi."
Completely at random, he pointed at Arthur and Fenchurch, who wrestled their way back out of the crowd and clustered urgently around the taxi.
"All right, I want you to clear a passage, please, for some important pieces of scientific equipment," boomed Ford. "Just everybody keep calm. It's all under control. There's nothing to see. It is merely a major scientific breakthrough. Keep calm now. Important scientific equipment. Clear the way."
Hungry for new excitement, delighted at the sudden reprieve from disappointment, the crowd enthusiastically fell back and started to open up. Arthur was a little surprised to see what was printed on the boxes of important scientific equipment in the back of the taxi. "Hang your coat over them," he muttered to Fenchurch as he heaved them out to her. Hurriedly, he manoeuvred out the large supermarket trolley that was also jammed against the back seat. it clattered to the ground, and together they loaded the boxes into it. "Clear a path, please!" shouted Ford again. "Everything's under proper scientific control."
"He said you'd pay," said the taxi driver to Arthur, who dug out some notes and paid him. There was the distant sound of police sirens.
"Move along there," shouted Ford, "and no one will get hurt."
The crowd surged and closed behind them again, as frantically they pushed and hauled the rattling supermarket trolley through the rubble towards the ramp.
"It's all right," Ford continued to bellow. "There is nothing to see. It's all over. None of this is actually happening."
"Clear the way, please," boomed a police megaphone from the back of the crowd. "There's been a break-in. Clear the way."
"Breakthrough," yelled Ford in competition. "A scientific breakthrough."
"This is the police. Clear the way."
"Scientific equipment. Clear the way."
"Police, let us through."
"Walkman,"
yelled Ford, and pulled half a dozen miniature tape players from his pockets and tossed them into the crowd. The resulting seconds of utter confusion allowed them to get the supermarket trolley to the edge of the ramp and to haul it up onto the lip of it.
"Hold tight," muttered Ford, and released a button on his electronic thumb. Beneath them, the huge ramp juddered and began slowly to heave its way upwards.
"Okay, kids," he said as the milling crowd dropped away beneath them and they started to lurch their way along the tilting ramp into the bowels of the ship. "Looks like we're on our way."
Chapter 39. Arthur Dent was irritated to be continually awakened by the sound of gunfire. Being careful not to wake Fenchurch, who was still managing to sleep fitfully, he slid his way out of the maintenance hatchway, which they had fashioned into a kind of bunk for themselves, slung himself down the access ladder, and prowled the corridors moodily. They were claustrophobic and ill-lit. The lighting circuits buzzed annoyingly. That wasn't it, though. He paused and leaned backwards as a flying power drill flew past him, down the dim corridor with a nasty screech, occasionally clanging against the walls like a confused bee as it did so. That wasn't it, either. He clambered through a bulkhead door and found himself in a larger corridor. Acrid smoke was drifting up from one end, so he walked towards the other. He came to an observation monitor let into the wall behind a plate of toughened but still badly scratched perspex. "Would you turn it down, please?" he said to Ford Prefect, who was crouching in front of it in the middle of a pile of bits of video equipment he had taken from a shop window in Tottenham Court Road, having first hurled a small brick through it, and also a nasty heap of empty beer cans. "Shh!" hissed Ford, and peered with manic concentration at the screen. He was watching The Magnificent Seven.
"Just a bit," said Arthur.
"No!" shouted Ford. "We're just getting to the good bit. Listen, I finally got it all sorted out. Voltage levels, line conversion, everything. And this is the good bit."
With a sigh and a headache, Arthur sat down beside him and watched the good bit. He listened to Ford's whoops and yells and yeeys as placidly as he could. "Ford," he said eventually when it was all over, and Ford was hunting through a stack of cassettes for the tape of Casablanca, "how come if..."
"This is the big one," said Ford. "This is the one I came back for. Do you realise I never saw it all through? Always I missed the end. I saw half of it again the night before the Vogons came. When they blew the place up, I thought I'd never get to see it. Hey, what happened with all that, anyway?"
"Just life," said Arthur, and plucked a beer from a six-pack.
"Oh, that again," said Ford. "I thought it might be something like that. I prefer this stuff," he said, as Rick's bar flickered onto the screen.
"How come if what?"
"What?"
"You started to say, how come if... how come if you're so rude about the Earth that you..." "Oh, never mind. Let's just watch the movie."
"Exactly," said Ford.
Chapter 40. There remains little still to tell. Beyond what used to be known as the limitless light fields of Flannox, until the grey binding fiefdoms of Saxoquin were discovered lying behind them, lie the grey binding fiefdoms of Saxoquin. Within the grey-binding fiefdoms of Saxoquin lies the star named Zas, around which orbits the planet Priliumtarn, in which is the land of Sevelbeopstri. And it was to the land of Sevelbeopstri that Arthur and Fenchurch came at last, a little tired by the journey. And in the land of Sevelbeopstri they came to the great red plain of Raz, which was bounded on the south side by the Quenchilus Quasgar Mountains, on the further side of which, according to the dying words of Prak, they would find in 30-foot-high letters of fire God's final message to his creation. According to Prak, if Arthur's memory served him right, the place was guarded by the logistic Vantrashell of Lob. And so, after a manner, it proved to be. He was a little man in a strange hat, and he sold them a ticket. "Keep to the left, please," he said, "keep to the left," and hurried on past them on a little scooter. They realized they were not the first to pass that way, for the path that led around the left of the great plain was well-worn and dotted with booths. At one they bought a box of fudge, which had been baked in an oven in a cave in the mountain, which was heated by the fire of the letters that formed God's final message to his creation. At another they bought some postcards. The letters had been blurred with an airbrush, "so as not to spoil the big surprise," it said on the reverse. "Do you know what the message is?" they asked the wizened little lady in the booth. "Oh, yes," she piped cheerily. "Oh, yes." She waved them on. Every 20 miles or so, there was a little stone hut with showers and sanitary facilities, but the going was tough, and the high sun baked down on the great red plain, and the great red plain rippled in the heat. "Is it possible," asked Arthur at one of the larger booths, "to rent one of these little scooters, like the one Logistic Venture Watsit had?" "The scooters," said the little lady who was serving at the ice cream bar, "are not for the devout." "Oh, well, that's easy, then," said Fenchurch. "We're not particularly devout, we're just interested." "Then you must turn back now," said the little lady severely, and when they demurred, sold them a couple of final message sun hats and a photograph of themselves with their arms tight around each other on the great red plain of Raz. They drank a couple of sodas in the shade of the booth and then trudged out into the sun again. "We're running out of barrier cream," said Fenchurch after a few more miles. "We can go on to the next booth, or we can return to the previous one, which is nearer, but means we have to retrace our steps again." They stared ahead at the distant black speck winking in the heat haze. They looked behind themselves. They elected to go on. They then discovered that they were not only not the first to make this journey, but they were not the only ones making it now. Some way ahead of them, an awkward low shape was heaving itself wretchedly along the ground, stumbling painfully slowly, half limping, half crawling. It was moving so slowly that before too long they caught the creature up and could see that it was made of worn, scarred and twisted metal. It groaned at them as they approached it, collapsing in the hot, dry dust. "So much time," it groaned. "Oh, so much time, and pain as well, so much of that. And so much time to suffer it in, too. One or the other on its own I could probably manage. It's the two together that really get me down. Oh, hello, you again."
"Marvin," said Arthur sharply, crouching down beside it, "is that you?"
"You were always one," groaned the aged husk of the robot, "for the super-intelligent question, weren't you?"
"What is it?"
whispered Fenchurch in alarm, crouching down behind Arthur and grasping onto his arm. "He's a sort of an old friend," said Arthur. "I..."
"Friend," croaked the robot pathetically. The word died away in a kind of crackle, and flakes of rust fell out of his mouth. "You'll have to excuse me while I try and remember what the word means. My memory banks are not what they were, you know, and any word which falls into disuse for a few zillion years has to get shifted down into auxiliary memory backup. Ah, here it comes."
The robot's battered head snapped up a bit, as if in thought.
He said, "what a curious concept."
He thought a little longer.
"No," he said at last, "don't think I ever came across one of those. Sorry, can't help you there."
He scraped a knee along pathetically in the dust, and then tried to twist himself up onto his misshapen elbows.
"Is there any last service you would like me to perform for you, perhaps?" he asked in a kind of hollow rattle. "A piece of paper that perhaps you would like me to pick up for you, or maybe you would like me," he continued, "to open a door."
His head scratched around in its rusty neck bearings and seemed to scan the distant horizon.
"Don't seem to be any doors around at present," he said, "but I'm sure that if we waited long enough, someone would build one. And then, he said, slowly twisting his head round to see Arthur again. "I could open it for you. I'm quite used to waiting, you know."
"Arthur," hissed Fenchurch in his ear sharply, "you never told me of this. What have you done to this poor creature?"
"Nothing," insisted Arthur sadly. "He's always like this."
"Ha!" snapped Marvin. "Ha!" he repeated. "What do you know of always? You say always to me, who, because of the silly little errands your organic life forms keep on sending me through time on, am now 37 times older than the universe itself. Pick your words with a little more care," he coughed, "and tact."
He rasped his way through a coughing fit and resumed. "Leave me," he said. "Go on ahead. Leave me to struggle painfully on my way. My time at last is nearly come. My race is nearly run. I fully expect," he said, feebly waving them on with a broken finger, "to come in last. It would be fitting. Here I am, brain the size." Between them, they picked him up, despite his feeble protests and insults. The metal was so hot it nearly blistered their fingers, but he weighed surprisingly little and hung limply between their arms. They carried him with them along the path that ran along the left of the great red plain of Ra's towards the encircling mountains of Quentula's Quasgar. Arthur attempted to explain to Fenchurch, but was too often interrupted by Marvin's dolorous cybernetic ravings. They tried to see if they could get him some spare parts at one of the booths and some soothing oil, but Marvin would have none of it. "I am all spare parts," he droned. "Let me be," he groaned. "Every part of me," he moaned, "has been replaced at least 50 times, except..." He seemed almost imperceptibly to brighten for a moment. His head bobbed between them with the effort of memory. "Do you remember the first time you ever met me?" he said at last to Arthur. "I had been given the intellect-stretching task of taking you up to the bridge. I mentioned to you that I had this terrible pain in all the diodes down my left side, that I had asked for them to be replaced, but they never were." He left a longish pause before he continued. They carried him on between them, under the baking sun that hardly ever seemed to move, let alone set. "See if you can guess," said Marvin, when he judged that the pause had become embarrassing enough, "which parts of me were never replaced. Go on, see if you can guess." "Ouch," he added. "Ouch, ouch, 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 ouch." At last they reached the last of the little booths, set Marvin down between them, and rested in the shade. Fenchurch bought some cufflinks for Russell, cufflinks that had set in them little polished pebbles which had been picked up from the Quentula's Quasgar Mountains, directly underneath the letters of fire in which was written God's final message to his creation. Arthur flipped through a little rack of devotional tracts on the counter, little meditations on the meaning of the message. "Ready?" he said to Fenchurch, who nodded. They heaved up Marvin between them. They rounded the foot of the Quentula's Quasgar Mountains, and there was the message, written in blazing letters along the crest of the mountain. There was a little observation vantage point, with a rail built along the top of a large rock facing it, from which you could get a good view. It had a little pay telescope for looking at the letters in detail, but no one would ever use it, because the letters burned with the divine brilliance of the heavens and would, if seen through a telescope, have severely damaged the retina and optic nerve. They gazed at God's final message in wonderment and were slowly and ineffably filled with a great sense of peace and a final and complete understanding. Then Church sighed.
"Yes," she said. "That was it."
They had been staring at it for fully 10 minutes before they became aware that Marvin, hanging between their shoulders, was in difficulties. The robot could no longer lift his head, had not read the message. They lifted his head, but he complained that his vision circuits had almost gone. They found a coin and helped him to the telescope. He complained and insulted them, but they helped him look at each individual letter in turn. The first letter was a W, the second an E, then there was a gap. An A followed, then a P, an O, and an L. Marvin paused for a rest. After a few moments, they resumed and let him see the O, the G, the I, the S, and the E. The next two words were for and the. The last one was a long one, and Marvin needed another rest before he could tackle it. It started with I, then N, then a C. Next came an O and an N, followed by a V, an E, another N, and an I. After a final pause, Marvin gathered his strength for the last stretch. He read the E, the N, the C, and at last the final E, and staggered back into their arms. "I think," he murmured at last from deep within his corroding, rattling thorax. "I feel good about it." The lights went out in his eyes for absolutely the very last time ever. Luckily, there was a stall nearby where you could rent scooters from guys with green wings. Epilogue. One of the greatest benefactors of all lifekind was a man who couldn't keep his mind on the job in hand. Brilliant? Certainly. One of the foremost genetic engineers of his or any other generation, including a number he had designed himself? Without a doubt. The problem was that he was far too interested in things which he shouldn't be interested in, at least, as people would tell him, not now. He was also, partly because of this, of a rather irritable disposition. So, when his world was threatened by terrible invaders from a distant star, who were still a fair way off but travelling fast, he, Blart Versenweld III, his name was Blart Versenweld III, which is not strictly relevant, but quite interesting because, never mind, that was his name and we can talk about why it's interesting later, was sent into guarded seclusion by the masters of his race, with instructions to design a breed of fanatical super-warriors to resist and vanquish the feared invaders, do it quickly, and, they told him, concentrate. So he sat by a window and looked out at a summer lawn and designed and designed and designed, but inevitably got a little distracted by things, and by the time the invaders were practically in orbit around them, had come up with a remarkable new breed of superfly that could, unaided, figure out how to fly through the open half of a half-open window, and also an off-switch for children. Celebrations of these remarkable achievements seemed doomed to be short-lived because disaster was imminent as the alien ships were landing. But astoundingly, the fearsome invaders, who, like most warlike races, were only on the rampage because they couldn't cope with things at home, were stunned by Versenwald's extraordinary breakthroughs, joined in the celebrations, and were instantly prevailed upon to sign a wide-ranging series of trading agreements and set up a program of cultural exchanges. And, in an astonishing reversal of normal practice in the conduct of such matters, everybody concerned lived happily ever after. There was a point to the story, but it has temporarily escaped the chronicler's mind.
Copyright 1993, Dove Audio Incorporated.